Since 2004, the Spaghetti Western Database has been the premier online resource for fans of the celebrated European movie genre. SWDB boasts a large collection of interviews, lists, film and home video reviews, images, and is updated daily to provide the most detailed information available. With a dedicated global community of contributors and powered by a lightning-fast, easy-to-navigate MediaWiki software, everything you want to know about Spaghetti Western cinema is right at your fingertips. Visit the SWDB today, located online at www.spaghetti-western.net.
You believe in Jesus?
Yes, I do.
Well, you're going to meet him.
You see what fun this is? It's going to get really exciting. I know what to do now. They've made it clear.
You warriors are good. Real good. The best.
This is the end of your rotten life, you motherfucking dope pusher.
We'd make one hell of a team, Snake.
The name's Plissken.
Back with another episode of 42nd Street Forever, the official podcast of Grindhouse Cinema Database. I'm Pete Roberts, and I'm here with my co-host, Sebastian Hasselbeck. Hey, Seb.
Hi there, Pete. How are you?
Good. I'm doing good. And today's film is from 1977, and it played at Cine 42, and it starred William Devane, Tommy Lee Jones, and Linda Haynes. It's Rolling Thunder, which was directed by John Flynn.
He's been away for 8 years. Now he's coming home.
Speaking for myself, I'd like to say that the whole experience has made a better man, a better officer, and a better American out of me. Thank you very much.
But the world has changed.
I've been with another man.
You don't remember me, do you?
And he's changed too.
Pull it up in the air like you're going to take me clear on up to the ceiling.
All right.
Now higher, man, higher, till you hear the bones starting to crack. That's it. Higher! Come on, higher! Higher!
I gotta go now.
What do you expect me to do, just drop everything? What is wrong with you?
You're driving too slow.
It's going to take some time to readjust.
Charlie! Ah!
Shut up!
Your husband, he's got a whole bag of silver dollars, and if I don't get him, he's gonna die.
No, don't. Please don't.
I wish you could remember something. A name, a face, an accent, anything.
I can't.
You can't just let it slide, Major. They don't have any right to live.
There's a storm brewing in this man. They took his arm. They took his family. And his soul. His anger is building, and it's going to explode. Now, from Paul Schrader, the author of Taxi Driver, comes a new and shattering film about a man poised on the brink of violence. Rolling Thunder, starring William Devane as Charles Rain. He has a purpose. He has a plan. It's only a matter of time.
I found them.
Who?
The men who killed my son.
I'll just get my gear.
There's the four that came into my home. And there's eight or ten of them.
Let's go clean them up.
Rolling Thunder.
And we were talking a little bit before, like, we started recording, that for us, like, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and you grew up in the 90s and 2000s, I think. Right. You're a little, like, 10 years younger than me. But for us, like, I didn't know of Rolling Thunder till probably the late 90s, early 2000s. But when it, growing up, like the first film I saw by John Flynn was Out for Justice that starred Steven Seagal. And that was back when I was a fan of him. I'm not really a fan of him anymore, but for, you know, certain reasons, if you know what's going on. And then you brought up Lock Up, which starred Sylvester Stallone. That was another good one. Those were good, like, genre
prison movies.
Films. Yeah. So that's like sort of like how we, you know, knew John Flynn from. But then, of course, later on, we learned about Rolling Thunder from Quentin Tarantino, who named his DVD distribution company after it, Rolling Thunder Pictures, and he put out like several like films that we really like, grindhouse movies that we really like, Switchblade mm-hmm. Sisters and Detroit 9000 and Mighty Peking Man. So that's sort of like that's where we first knew it from, and then we watched it, and you know that's become one of our favorite films. But I just thought since we're doing like the grindhouse theme, I wanted to every film like you know is actually played on the deuce. So I found out that Rolling Thunder actually played in October of 1977 on the Deuce at Cine 42. And I thought that would be a good movie to discuss because just for that reason, basically, and that we're fans of the movie too. So,
yeah, it is a good movie to discuss.
Excellent revenge
in general. Right. Revenge-o-matic.
And another thing I wanted to mention was I wanted to dedicate this episode to Linda Haynes, who just passed away last July. She plays Linda Forche in the movie. And also for, you know, grindhouse movie fans, they'll know her from Coffee because she played Meg. She plays King George's like, you know, main squeeze in that movie. If you remember
right,
that.
That's right.
She's also the girl that like Coffee, like dumps a big bowl of salad on her head. That's like that scene where they have the cat fight. That's a kind of like a little famous little scene. So if you know that movie, that's where she was. She was in that movie before this one, but.
You know where really I remember her from? I remember because you mentioned Lock Up, which is a prison movie. She was also in Brubaker, another excellent.
Oh yeah, Brubaker. That's sort of like connected to Lock Up, another like you know guy that goes into prison. Yeah, I forgot about that. And it's funny. I've seen that movie Brubaker, but I can't really remember her. So maybe I just because I haven't seen it enough. But I just remember like them being in like prison and stuff. But I don't remember her part as much. But she's really great in this movie, and you know she's just excellent actress.
But, yeah, and maybe as a fun fact, when I went to high school, one of the topics I was preoccupied with in I think in English class or whatever was the genre of Vietnam vets coming back from the war type movies, which is I would say a subgenre of the Vietnam War movie genre.
Right. Or the war movie, a subgenre of war movies or something.
And this is of course one in a whole bunch of movies that fit that the description. We have a listicle on furiouscinema.com actually
with all the Viet or like top 20 Vietnam vet movies or something.
Yeah, I think Coming Home and Taxi Driver and
First Blood.
What's the Combat Shock?
Yeah, Combat Shock. But I was thinking to myself, like when I was growing up, the film that I didn't know about Rolling Thunder, like I was saying, until like later on, like when I was probably in my teens, early 20s when I found out about that movie. But the film that I thought was closest that I saw when I was growing up was First Blood, because it's different, obviously, because the main thing is Rambo is like a Green Beret, like Special Forces guy, and Rain is like a Air Force guy that gets captured and thrown in as a POW. So there's that difference. But the whole thing of them coming home and like how they deal, like, you know, psychologically how they're dealing with things. So the whole thing with Rambo was that's basically like an all out action film. And you actually see him like snap and like go crazy. And then like, you know, he goes off into the woods and stuff and he's fighting them. But that's where the difference is between them, because then Rolling Thunder, as we were talking offline, the character of Major Charles Rain, he's very controlled and he's not like, you know, he's not like going crazy or anything. It's all his stuff is very internal, and he keeps control of all of his psychological issues, pretty much. I mean, all, you know, he doesn't go nuts and like, you know, start going crazy with guns and stuff.
But also,
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, but also First Blood and Rolling Thunder at the opposite ends in another way, because when Rain comes home, they're celebrated and received as heroes. Whereas Rambo, he's being rejected by the society he was supposed
to be fighting for. Right. So that adds to the whole thing. So, you know, like you can see, but the whole thing with Rain was he comes home, and while he's treated like a hero by the public, he goes home and basically his family life is just destroyed. Yeah. And so he has to deal with his wife who's cheating on him with like some local, I think a cop that got cop Cliff from, you know, that kind of like moves in and like, you know, he tries to take over as the kid's father. And then like his son, who doesn't really want to connect with him at all. You can see that they're just, you know, there's nothing.
He was probably too young when he left.
Right. So like he almost doesn't know him when he comes home. So
well, I think so he then. Doesn't.
So then the only thing that really holds, you know, hit him together at that time is he meets Linda Forche, who is sort of like a groupie, like, you know, like that's what she calls herself, like a groupie, like a, you know, because she kind of like, I don't know if that she sent him letters or something, like she had like, you know, kept him like in contact with him or something while he was in Vietnam.
She wore her like his
a bracelet or something like that, or yeah, something like that. But anyway, she's sort of like his, you know, like she kind of like fills in the void where his family is all screwed up. She's like, you know, she kind of comes into his life and, you know, tries to like connect with him and, you know, have a relationship, but he's like totally like just shut down completely. He just doesn't want to do anything. And then also we forgot to mention Tommy Lee Jones's character is Raines' like buddy from like Vietnam, and he's even more of a zombie. He's just like a total zombie in this movie. That like both of them are just like kind of like two aliens landing on a strange planet where they don't belong type. That's the feeling you get when you see them. Exactly. And they don't talk very much either.
No, they don't. And I think what the movie captures really well, and you mentioned this earlier when we talked before we started the show also, is that there is not a lot of dialogue in the movie because these two, they don't have much to tell. They have spent, I don't know how many years in a
POW camp or something.
Or whatever. Like, it's like the John McCain type story. They got shut down. Right. They got locked up. They got tortured. Right. What are they going to tell people? Like, how they were tortured? They have nothing.
Right.
They have no stories, no experiences, no anecdotes. They're not kind of the type of war veteran that would go and tell a story about how they shot down enemy planes or
They weren't on the ground either,
the country. They were not on the ground, and that's I think where the title of the movie comes in, is because Rolling Thunder was the code name for the bombing campaign of Laos in Cambodia. These guys were not supposed to be shot down. They were supposed to fly above the clouds, drop a bunch of bombs and fly back.
And it also works as like another way, because of course Rolling Thunder, like, you know, that's implies a storm is coming. And when you watch the movie, at least at the first half, almost every other scene between the characters has this like feeling of tension going on underneath the surface that isn't being shown or told. So it's like those two things are kind of, you know, they're two sides of the same coin, basically, is what you're saying. It's like it actually was an Operation Rolling Thunder in Vietnam. And then you have the Rolling Thunder of like, you know, the coming storm, like, but we don't really know what it's going to be until the end, obviously.
Yeah, and it's almost like, as you mentioned, he comes home to he was probably not expecting life to be perfect when he came home, because there's a scene where he said, well, we all knew it. Basically, this is what, you know, what most of the guys went through is after all these years.
Right.
Chances are the wife's already remarried, kids are grown up, whatever. Right. Maybe you lost your house or I don't know, all these things. So he reacts pretty coldly to that new reality, sort of. But at the same time, it's like, not only do they not have anything to tell, but also they don't have anything to do because they're completely empty. So they don't have a hobby, interest, they don't have any education, they don't have any chops training aside from flying.
So they're not going to go dancing or something. They're not going to, like, you know.
So they find themselves in a place that was looking forward to them being back, but then they don't have anything to offer them.
They're like in limbo, like, type thing.
Yeah, and then that's why he's, I mean, as you said, there's something brewing, but at the same time, you know, there's a scene where he goes out to the tool shed and has his the guy who's now dating his wife has him tie his hands together and whatever.
That's a great scene too.
Yeah, it's almost like he's missing his POW life, sort of, because at least that kept him occupied.
he had a purpose when he was
his purpose was to be tortured, but at least that was some kind of purpose.
Yeah, you learn to love the rope. That whole scene was like one of the best scenes in the movie. Like, you know, he loved the rope.
Exactly.
Showing his wife's, like, you know, the guy that she cheated on with him, like, he's showing like how he got through it by, like, you know, going through the torture that they did. Like, they'd tie his arms behind his back and like pull him up in the air, and actually that was sort of like what they did to Rambo. So that little scene where they do like the little flashbacks, Rambo, like the First Blood, kind of took some of those ideas, I think, and kind of they'd show like some of the flashbacks of him, like, you know, when he was thinking back on the torture and stuff.
One question though is when he says when he shows that to the guy who's dating his wife.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that's his way of telling him, you know what, that's just nothing. What you're doing to me, that's just nothing.
That's what I think. I think all that stuff is in there. All that stuff is in, like, underneath the surface. That's like what I was kind of saying, like all these little scenes, there's always something like underneath that what he's saying. Like, and he's also saying, like, you know, yeah, you're a big tough cop. Well, I've done this and I'm probably tougher than you are. And he's doing it in a way where, but he's not saying it directly to him. He's like just like showing him something, and he's kind of like, you know, he's implying it but without saying it outright, you know what I mean? Instead of having like a fist fight or something over his wife, he's just showing like what he's been through, that he can take anything basically. So what you're saying is right. You know?
Yeah, it's also, I mean, I've been thinking about this, and he's not asking for admiration or pity. Right.
Yeah,
or
he's not at all.
Everything is really just something settled. I mean, he's almost he's a very sad character in a way, because he has nothing to show for himself. Right. Also, it's not like, I mean, obviously they gave him a bunch of medals just for surviving it.
Right.
But it's not. I mean, he's not a hero because he accomplished something. He's just a hero because he didn't die.
Right.
So also, there's no story there for him from this war.
Right, he's
not like, you know, he didn't storm the beaches of Normandy or he didn't kill Bin Laden or whatever. He just didn't die.
And this also reminds me of The Searchers with John Wayne's character, and that's sort of, that connects to like Taxi Driver too. That whole thing with, like, you know, those two movies are kind of connected too. But just the whole idea of Ethan Edwards and in The Searchers, how he comes home and, like, you know, he's like a hero and stuff, but he really doesn't have anybody. He's just completely alone. And like at the end of the movie, you know, the end of the movie, when he walks out of the door and, like, you know, the whole family goes inside, and then he like kind of walks off into the desert by himself. It's sort of like him and Rain and Johnny in this movie are sort of like both like that character. They're both kind of like really like just zombies in a way. They just don't, you know, they're like walking dead type people. And, like, you know, that just shows when Rain's with Linda Forche, like, you know, they get together later on, and when they're together, like, he can't even like really do anything with her. He's just so, like, he doesn't have anything to give her anymore. It's because he's just empty with, like, from what's happened to him. But another thing I wanted to get into was what we were talking about earlier offline, was the dialogue that Paul Schrader wrote. Like, you know, the original script that Paul Schrader wrote was very like different than this movie. There was a lot more dialogue coming from Rain and like the other characters. But then also Haywood Gould came on and did rewrites, and he rewrote, like, you know, the final film. But actually the final rewritten script was by William Devane, who changed a lot of the, you know, he took out a lot of the dialogue that Rain says, and I think that was a smart thing, like I was saying to you, was he was more of like in line with like a Steve McQueen in Bullet or a Clint Eastwood, like, you know, one of his characters, how they wouldn't talk a lot. They would just use their like behavior and physicality instead of like just, you know, rambling on about stuff. And I think in this, when you watch this movie, I think that just makes sense. I think that was the right choice for this film, instead of having Rain be like, oh, yeah, giving like, you know, kind of, because the more people talk, it's like, you know, that's not what he wants to convey as the character. He doesn't want to be like a talkative, like, you know, happy person. He's just like less is more, like, type of approach, which I think made more sense.
Yeah, plus he's not the type of character where it would be plausible for him to be sharing so much, because he really doesn't have anything to say.
Like you were saying earlier, like, you know, they don't have like a lot to, you know, the stuff they would tell you would be like horrifying. So they're not going to be like telling you like all these horror stories about being like in, you know, POW camp and stuff. It just doesn't, you know. And another thing is, they probably weren't super talkative even before this stuff happened. They're those types of guys, like, they're like kind of like the silent, you know, the strong silent type.
They're pilots. People, you know, I mean, they're up there, you know, and they're probably, I mean,
they're very, like, you know,
pilots are an elite bunch. They probably probably didn't socialize with, you know, other folks. They probably hung out on amongst themselves. And
like, there are scenes like between Rain and Johnny where like the scene, remember the scene where he's at the hospital and he's like wheeling him out on the wheelchair, and he takes him like for a little walk. So he wheels him out to like a little seat, or like a little under a tree, and like they stand there for a minute, and he goes, "Oh, you want me to take you back?" And he just wheels him back and then leaves him. Like, it's just weird. It's like they don't have any like real discussions about anything. It's almost like they're thinking the same way. You know what I mean? Like they have the same ideas, so they don't need to like talk it out verbally. They can just like read each other's minds or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's they've been like through strange. The same thing, yeah. So between them, they have the only bond,
right,
that matters, exactly, so to speak, and nobody, right, else would understand what they have.
Right.
And also, I mean, as you mentioned, a taxi driver earlier. Of course, there's that kind of Charlie Rain type veteran, but also there's the, right, Travis Bickle kind who comes home, right, and he's pissed off, angry. Right. Doesn't understand the world, has, right, ideas and goes nuts. And of course that sort of character is talkative because he has pent up anger and, right, ideas and confusion, and he needs to vent and, right, justify and explain it to himself, explain it to others. And I think that's where the two are very, very different in right, their experience also, even though we have to say that, I don't know about the script, but there's nothing about Travis Bickle that we know in terms of what kind of reception he had when he came back from the war, because Taxi, right, Driver starts off.
He's already like a taxi driver at that point.
Yeah, yeah, he starts off much later. So,
right.
But there must be, so Bickle is a much more political figure, whereas, right, Rain is just no figure at all. He's just, right, as you say, he's a zombie.
Just kind of blank. And another thing I thought was interesting was like he lives when the movie starts, like, you know, it's like that has that song San Antonio, I'm, you know, really glad to see you, like, you know, it has like, yeah, those. But the whole thing with Rain was I didn't get the sense that he's from Texas at all. It's almost like he's just like maybe he was stationed there or something, and like that's where he ended up living, because he doesn't have like an accent or anything. He doesn't come off, mm-hmm, like a Texan, mm-hmm, type person. But that's, I don't know if that's true, you know, that's could be just speculation on my part. I don't know if that's what that is, but anyways, and then Paul Schrader, I got a quote from him, and he said, "You could see Rolling Thunder as a more overtly actionful companion piece to Taxi Driver. The critics seemed keen to dismiss it as lightweight or mindless, but Rolling Thunder was able to explore things we didn't touch on in Taxi Driver. The flashbacks to Devane's time in captivity, for example, in the scene where Devane asks his wife's new fella to tie him up the way the Viet Cong used to. I don't think that's something that you'd get in your standard mindless action movie. Concluding with a gunfight that is every bit as compelling as Taxi Driver's denouement, Rolling Thunder's content upset everybody from preview audiences to studios to the studio that bankrolled at 20th Century Fox. And he said Fox was so disturbed by the violence, they'd seen films like Taxi Driver and were aware that motion pictures were moving in that direction. But when they saw what they paid for, they couldn't get rid of Rolling Thunder quickly enough. But I also feel like Rolling Thunder, like when I watch other movies, like Grindhouse movies, I feel like it was a little bit more. There was more to it than just the standard, like, you know, action and violence and stuff. Because as we know, it was more of like a character study, or part character study, and then part revenge-o-matic, you know?
Yeah, and at the same time, I guess two thoughts here. Rolling Thunder is a very minimalistic, a very lean movie. You know, there's not, right, much dialogue, there's not, right, too much happening.
Yep.
And the second thing is that a Taxi Driver, even though there's a certain degree of violence in it, it is much more pop cultural. There's much more going on that, mm-hmm, I don't want to say it makes it more mainstream, but there's a lot more to go on for a mainstream audience. Whereas for Rolling Thunder, it's slimmed down to the essentials.
Right. It is. It's pretty bleak. Like it's bleak, very dark and bleak.
That, you know, that there's not much of an entertainment factor. There's not many, right, colors. There's not many side things going on. It doesn't, right, have as much of a visual aesthetic and all these, right, things. So it's really more, and I think that's a suitable comparison. Rolling Thunder is a lot more Peckinpah. It's, you know, there's not, right, so much music, there's not so much artsiness, it's not overloaded with stuff, it's just really bare bones story,
right,
on one character, one experience, and then it is very slow, it is quiet, and then it bursts. Whereas Taxi Driver is not quiet. You, right, see you see a lot more going on, especially you hear and feel and see what's going on in his head. And that's not the case here.
This is more like, you know, you're watching the stuff unfold, but with Taxi Driver, as we know, it's coming from, you're watching through Travis's point of view. So you're seeing like the world through his eyes, and there's so much stuff. And obviously, like, you know, that takes place in New York City versus the, you know, the country of Texas, you know, the countryside of Texas and, you know, the Mexican areas and stuff. That's just a different atmosphere. So that's a lot of it too. Like there's a lot of like stuff going on in the city basically. And, you know, there's,
yeah, but also not only does Bickle have a political agenda and an opinion and everything, but also he does have an agenda, period. Right. He's constantly thinking of something and planning something. So so you at the audience, you expect something to happen. Right. Whereas Rain, he's not planning anything. Something happened. No, something's happening to him, and then he's reacting.
Right.
So it's a completely different premise. I mean, of course, it makes Rolling Thunder super interesting because once he does, you know, once he does get into
decide what he wants to do. Yeah,
then he decides what he wants to do. But also, I think for the most part, Rain's super happy because he's finally back to, you know, what
he has a motive, like he has like a purpose to like keep living, basically, because he's just totally like, in a way, like, you know, the whole thing with him getting, you know, robbed of his coins, like, you know, they give at the beginning of the film, they give him, you know,
he didn't give a shit about the coins.
Yeah, he didn't give, but I'm just saying, like, you know, he had those coins and stuff, and like he wasn't going to give them up, but like that, all that stuff that happened to him almost like gave him a purpose to keep on breathing, basically, because he just didn't have anything, because his, like we were saying, the family life was pretty much destroyed. And another thing I thought was weird was when, like, you know, he's planning to get revenge on the, you know, the guys that killed his wife and kid. And he's like, he never mentions his wife. He says, I found the kid, the guys that got that killed my son, but he never mentions the wife. So there was some like weird thing where he just didn't even give a crap about the wife for some reason. It's like, you know, it was like she was dead to him or something. It was just interesting.
Yeah. And also, I mean, as you mentioned, Tommy Lee Jones, he's just as empty as he is, but also once Rain has a purpose again, he goes to him, what's his name, Johnny or whatever, and he says, I'll just get my gear.
Right.
That's probably the most dialogue.
And he also seems happy at that point. Like, you know, he's like, all of a sudden, like through the whole movie, he's been like totally like sullen and like totally like, you know, like he's almost like
finally.
You see him, like you see his actual, like he has actually has emotion again, like in his life from like when he finds out that he's going to go help him, like, you know, get rid of the guys that attacked him, you know what I mean? So that's like that whole thing. But
you know what it felt like to me? Crazy. It felt like he reactivates Johnny. They're both,
that's what I thought. That's exactly what I thought.
Inactive, like robots or whatever.
That's exactly what I wrote. I actually wrote that down, and I said he's like a ticking or a walking time bomb, and Rain activates him when he says, like, you know, like, let's go get the guys that, you know, killed my wife and son.
Yeah.
You know,
and I mean, then they drive off that across the border like the Wild Bunch, and it becomes even more Peck and Paw.
Right. And then it's like the Yakuna Boys. That's the name of the gang that, like, you know, run by James Best, who I knew growing up as Roscoe P. Coltrane from The Dukes of Hazzard. He plays like the main baddie in the movie. And I also wanted to mention Luke Askew. He plays Automatic Slim, one of the bad guys, and he was in Easy Rider, a couple of my favorite movies, Easy Rider and Cool Hand Luke. So I knew him from that, those movies.
And wasn't James Best also an acting teacher?
Yeah, that was Quentin Tarantino's acting teacher, James Best. So it's like there's a weird all connection to that stuff. I was just going to read another little bit with John Flynn, the director, in a little interview that he did, and it said in an interview, it said, how did critics and the public respond to Rolling Thunder when it was first released? And John Flynn said, we almost got killed when we previewed Rolling Thunder in San Jose. People were shocked by the extreme violence, especially the scene where a hand is ground up in a garbage disposal. Paul Schrader's script was reworked by a very fine writer, Haywood Gould. Back then, they were priming William Devane to be a big movie star. He's a wonderful actor, but he never became a big star. Tommy Lee Jones was sensational in this picture. Rolling Thunder was his breakthrough film. Linda Haynes was extraordinary. Today she is a legal secretary in Florida. I saw her when I was shooting Scam there in 93. We shot Rolling Thunder in San Antonio, Texas in 31 days. We knew we were doing something fairly bold. The producer, Lawrence Gordon, told me to shoot the garbage disposal scene like open heart surgery. Make it as bloody as I possibly could. So I did. When we submitted Rolling Thunder to the MPAA for a rating. We expected deep cuts, but the Uncensored passed Uncut, one of the most violent movies in the history of film. Rolling Thunder was given an R rating. Fox wanted to cut out all the violence and release Rolling Thunder to 42nd Street theaters, so Larry Gordon took it to Sam Arkoff at American International, and Arkoff bought it from Fox and released it almost uncut. He made one little trim in the garbage disposal scene. And he said, American International Pictures distributed as is without recutting it, and it made them a fortune. Yeah, so that was... And then William Devane said, it probably would have made a big difference if they had actually released it properly, but when they tested it, the Mexicans set the theater on fire. They were really, really down on it. So then the studio backed way off, and it never got the release it would have if they had jumped on it and supported it. But I didn't understand how to operate in those days. I still don't know how to operate. But a movie star guy would have done everything he could to force them to release it properly. And Tommy and I were just starting. God, that was the first feature role I ever did. Good picture, though. It's a really good picture. You know, they tried to do the same thing to Warren Beatty with Bonnie and Clyde, but Warren was hip enough and smart enough to know how to put enough pressure on them to get them to release that picture. And I didn't know how to do that. I just didn't have any idea.
Yeah, so I think we keep forgetting that. I mean, even though Schrader was a hot name in town, that neither Devane nor Tommy Lee Jones were big stars yet.
And now, right, they were just starting, so it wasn't like, you know,
other household names or
that's maybe see, I think that's the thing. If they had had a more established star in there, that would have helped it, and then it would have helped them get more, you know, promotional kudos and stuff like that. But another thing we were talking about was before William Devane was going to play Rain, they had some other directors and actors that were like, you know, potentially going to direct the movie, and like John Milius, he was like the first director that was going to do it, and I think he was going to work with Joe Don Baker, who we know from Walking Tall and like, you know, those movies. Like, he was in, you know, he was sort of like a up and coming, like you know,
would have made for a completely different movie, I think.
Yeah, it would have been different, but then Joe Don Baker worked with John Flynn on The Outfit. Did you ever see The Outfit? That was a really good movie. With
unfortunately, haven't
Robert Duvall. That's one of his like earlier movies. But so that probably would have been really good. Him and John Milius and Joe Don Baker. But I'm thinking like John Flynn and Joe Don Baker. But he wasn't going to direct it with him. That would have been someone else. But and then I guess George Romero was also attached to it at a certain point. That would have been different.
Well, he knows about zombies, that's for sure.
Yeah, there would be like no zombie. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking about zombies before the characters being like zombies, so that's kind of funny. But and then David Carradine was also attached to star in it at one point, but he turned it down. And I guess Kris Kristofferson was also attached to it too, but at some point, but I guess like he turned it down. So all those guys turned it down. Then William Devane got it and like kind of, you know, redid it with Haywood Gould and, you know. And he brought in some of the actors that he knew, and that's how the you know, like I think his wife and the guy that plays Cliff were like people that he was with, you know, in stage plays with, and he brought them in to take those parts. And I guess there was some like, you know, conflict with the director, like, you know, that he didn't exactly want these people, but then, you know, he just went along with it at the end. But I was going to mention the DP of the movie was Jordan Cronenweth, who directed one of our favorite movies, Blade Runner, or not directed, but photographed one of our favorite.
I was just going to say, that didn't even register with me, because I mentioned earlier that Rolling
Thunder, darkness of the movie,
doesn't have so much visceral aesthetic.
Right.
That just shows that Cronen was a very versatile kind of DP, because Rolling Thunder really isn't much of a visual movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it really isn't. I mean, it's, you know, it's well directed and well photographed, but it doesn't like have like a lot of like flash to it.
It is a very bare, not bare bones, but it's probably
it's
the
very bleak though, and dark, bleak and dark. If there's not a lot, you know, it's not like we were saying.
Also, there's no snails to it. You know, it's a no frills type movie. There's no.
Right.
Not like a Scorsese picture where, you know, the elaborate lighting and the city lights and whatever and the colors. And this is just really, it has an AIP look to it, let's be honest.
Right. Yeah, it does. And it's also not like, and it's not even like even if you're comparing it to like First Blood, there's no like really action adventure thing to this movie. It's almost like when he decides to go after the guys down in Mexico and stuff, those scenes are, they're very like, they're very spare. Like, they're not like, it's not like he's, you know, they have a few scenes where there's some action, but it's not like a movie where he's like an action hero or anything. It's just like, you know, there's that scene in the bar when he goes down and, like, you know, he hits the guy with the hook in the crotch and stuff, like, you know, and then they run out the door and like drive off. But it's not like, you know, it's not like the normal action movie where there's like a big, huge like fight scene and, like, you know, like people are like jumping out of like windows and stuff. It's just very like, you know, basic type stuff. It's not super, like you were saying, it's like sort of like a Sam, it's probably closer to a Sam Peckinpah movie, but there's not like a ton of slow motion like action in this movie either. It's just, it's more of like just straight up, you know, normal action, not stylized action, I mean.
Yeah, it's not, the whole movie is not stylized much.
Yeah, it's not. It's very like, I guess it's to make it more realistic looking. It's not supposed to be like, you know, it's just what would really happen. They're not trying to make it like, you know, really flashy and, you know, super exciting,
I think Schrader, I think Flynn wasn't out there to make a visually elaborate exciting movie. He was out there to tell a gritty story, and I think that's what he did. He did it well, but it's not, you know, some directors try to do both. They try to do something gritty, but also make it, you know, look fancy.
Right.
It's not the case here.
Like we were saying, like if this movie had been made like 10 years later or something, like in 87, it would be like a Lethal Weapon type, you know what I mean? It would be like more like a, like what we grew up, what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, the Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, you know, Kurt Russell, you know, like all those types of movies that were, it's like really action packed and like, you know, stylized action. But I suppose the reason it is such a good film as it is because it doesn't have all that stuff. It makes it more realistic. If it had come out later on, it would be more like, it wouldn't be like the character study that it is, the realistic character study. It would be more of like a, you know, just a like guy getting revenge and like more, it, like we were saying, like I was thinking it's more than a grindhouse movie when I watch it. I don't think of it as like a, I mean, it has some qualities from those movies, but there's more going on in this film than just, you know, just the normal revenge action type story. You know what I mean? There's more to it. You're getting to know the characters more deeply, and you spend more time with Charles Rain and stuff. And it's just a deeper film to me. I don't think it's just that's the difference. That's what makes it stand apart from most, you know, grindhouse films. Like if I saw this at the grindhouse back in the day, I'd be like, oh yeah, this is more of like a drama, like a, you know, like a, mm-hmm. like a, you know, like a it's like a psychological thriller almost. Not a thriller maybe, but like, you know, psychologically based. It's not like, you know, just a guy like, you know, gets done wrong and then goes out and starts like killing everybody and like, or, you know, like having all the action scenes. It's just different than that.
True, but also like just in terms of the aesthetic, it reminds me a lot of like early Robert Rodriguez movies, which
those like real like John Woo type movies? I mean, he was sort of inspired by John Woo and all that.
But even John Woo, I mean, aside from the slow motion and everything, his movies didn't have much of they didn't look like a Bertolucci picture. I mean, it's not like every frame is like a painting, you know?
I guess so.
This is a very no-frills movie. It doesn't look anything special, and I think that's fine.
It is good, but I mean,
It works more on a, as you say, on a psychological level.
I think where I'm coming from is I grew up on like the action movies. So when I watch a movie like this one, where there's not a lot of action, it's like you're just like spending time with the character, like for the first, you know, half of the film. It's like, you know, it's just a different experience. It's like if I had saw this when I was younger, I probably wouldn't have liked it as much as I do now, because I've learned how to watch a movie and like how to like, you know, examine and analyze it. But you know, I still think it's a really good movie. I don't know if it's like one of my all time favorites. Like, you know, if I had like a top 20 list, I don't know where it would fall on that. But I still think it's a very good revenge film. I mean, it's just excellent.
And speaking of the psychological impact, I think a lot has to do with the slow buildup and then the explosion of violence at the end. I want to overdo the violence, because I think, honestly, I mean, if you watch a lot of movies, it's not the most violent movie or anything. So
no, it isn't. It's not like even like The Wild Bunch or anything like that. It's sort of like a different level.
It's not even as bloody as Taxi Driver.
No, it's not even like that either. But
I mentioned Peckinpah earlier, because I think to me it has a very Peckinpah-esque feeling at the end. Yeah. I mean, A, because they're crossing the border, but also because it's, I mentioned this earlier when we talked. It has a bit of, it feels a bit like a suicide mission.
Right.
It's, you know, they scout the place out and they right. see how they can get in there. But then it feels like, to me, it feels like a half-assed plan in a way, right. almost like they don't even expect to make it out.
It is sort of like that type of idea. And also, but the other thing that I like about the movie is they, these guys have a code of honor too, I think, to them. You know what I mean? They're not just like crazy, like, you know, they're not just cowboying it, like, as they say. They're you know, they do have a code of honor that they're upholding. And another little thing that I thought of last time I watched it was, I don't know if this is true or not, but to me, it's almost like they're getting revenge for what the country did to them as like soldiers, not just for like, you know, Rain's family and stuff. Like, you know, there's little things that like you think of, like, you know, where psychologically are they coming from? And like that's something that I thought of, like that's another aspect of it, because it's not like the Vietnam thing wasn't like the normal type of war where it was so black and white. Like, you know, you have the Nazis, you know they were upholding like democracy and stuff like that. This was like such a screwed up war, and it totally, you know, it screwed them up psychologically. So there was some other reason, I think, they were like, you know, getting back at these guys. It wasn't just that. It was like some other reason too, I think, to me. I don't know if that's true or not, but it could be, you know what I mean? I don't know. It's just, it's probably, you know, like for Johnny Vodden, you know, Tommy Lee Jones's character, he's not like, you know, he's like we were saying, he's not, he was like a ticking, like a walking time bomb, and Rain, like, you know, flips the switch on him like at the end, and he's like, you know, he's almost like returns to being like a normal person again. You can see like how his emotions change. But I just feel like, you know, that there's more to it than just like, you know, the whole, you know, getting revenge for the family and like his hand and stuff. I just, that's what I thought, but who knows.
Yeah. And the other thing that first it did remind me a bit of The Getaway, stylistically, the way they filmed it, you know, with the staircases and stuff like that.
And the on the thing, border, like going like on
that too. And also just in terms of the choreography, I mean, it feels a very claustrophobic, chaotic type showdown. You know, it's not, so first off, it feels like a suicide mission, but also it also doesn't seem as you mentioned earlier, they're pilots, you know, they're not special forces.
They're not special forces guys. So it's like, they're kind of like not even like,
they may have seen,
I mean, they're
some
trained
action
for this stuff, but it's not like, you know, it's not like Rambo like type thing. It's like, you know, they're just kind of doing like the basic, like, you know, slamming open doors and like shooting at people and
so
stuff.
So I wonder if, you know, the way they were like hungry for this type of action, Rain's almost happy that he gets to see some action. Maybe that's how they've been there for the entire duration of the war until they got shut down. So they had they never saw any action, and they probably always had to listen to like other soldiers bragging and boasting or, I don't know, looking down on them because they are like, you know, they fly the bombers, go back and never see, you know, dead people. Maybe they were always sort of hungry to see actual action, and they never did see any. And now they do, and now they realize that, wait a second, this is not as as they had imagined it, and also they probably not qualified enough to walk out alive.
That's why I'm thinking, like, the whole thing I was just saying before was like, you know, they're looking for some way to like let loose like all their frustrations in a way, you know what I mean? It's not just the revenge thing they're doing. It's there's more to it than that, because it's just like the whole war thing, like being a prisoner of war, and then, like, you know, they were probably not able to get back at their captors, so they're like using some of that as a motivation to like go do what they're doing. Like, I don't know, that's what I thought about it a little bit. I can't tell you if that's the truth, because I don't know if that was part of, like, you know, in the you know, the script for the movie, but that's just what I thought, like, you know, from watching it several times. I think that's maybe, like, you know, one of the motivations besides just the, you know, like, oh, I'm going to get revenge because they killed these guys killed my son and my wife.
Yeah, because I don't, as you mentioned earlier, I mean, he's not really driven by revenge as much as I would say the purpose that he now has.
Yeah, that's true.
It could be anything. Like, it could be They
ran over my dog, and I'm gonna go get
right,
you know, whatever. I don't
like
know.
A John Wick type situation.
Yeah, it's like John Wicker.
It doesn't even matter to him like who they killed. I mean, the son didn't know him. The wife is estranged. Could have been brother or something else, or his favorite car or something.
Right. It's like, I just think it's like psychologically that's where he was kind of coming from. It wasn't just that stuff, and like, you know, the Tommy Lee Jones's character, I mean, he could have been like, you know, those guys, like, you know, hit my dog, or, you know, ran over my dog, or let's go get him. And he'd be like, okay, I'm going to get my machine gun and, you know, whatever. He didn't care. So, he didn't care what what the reason was. He just wanted to go do it, basically.
And also, I mean, so these guys are supposed to be soldiers and whatever. The gear that he brings and everything, it's the whole thing just seems very unprofessional to me.
I'm gonna go get my gear, and he just has like a shotgun in a bag, basically. That's what all he has.
Yeah. They didn't bring like M16s. They didn't, you know, dress up in a jumpsuit.
Tactical gear. They were wearing their, like, you know, their dress uniform, basically, which was kind of weird too, in a way. So what was that supposed to be? That was like, I think that was supposed to be their way of saying like, okay, we're not gonna return from this mission, so we're just gonna go out wearing our dress uniform so they'll find us in it or something. You know what I mean? That type of idea. They'll find us in our, you know, finest uniforms so they can bury us in them, basically.
Yeah, so that was, you know, the more I think of it, the more interesting this gets, because there is a build-up to this showdown, but then it's not the kind of showdown that you would expect. But then the more that you think about the two characters, the more it becomes clear that it couldn't have been any other way, because they're not the John Rambo type. So they're not professional enough to mount like a tactical assault.
Right. It's just like spur of the moment, like stuff like, oh yeah, they're in there, let's go get them. And I don't know what we're going to do. You have a gun and I have a gun. We'll just, like, you know, take them out however we can do it, basically.
It's like they go into a bar looking for a fight, and then realizing that all the guys are taller than they are or something.
And there is, like I was saying, there is like a Wild West aspect, like, you know, they're two like gunfighters going into the bar to get the outlaws, that, you know, the bad outlaws out in the up in the brothel or something. And I mean, that type of idea, I'm sure that's part of the, you know, the psychological, you know, underpinnings of the scenes.
Yeah, probably.
Wild West aspect.
And if you look at what Schrader does and what he would do later, it's always, now this is just, correct me if I'm totally off here, but he plays with the audience's
expectations.
Expectations and the usual
genre cliche.
Not cliches, but the preconception that you have of how something would have to go down or not. And then it's different, because his characters are usually not typical. They're usually something else.
They're like outsiders or the edge of society or something.
Yeah, or they are you know, fallible. They have flaws. They are not, you know, Superman or whatever.
Right.
I mean, how would the story unfold if it were John Rambo? I mean, he would have probably sneak in there at night and slit everyone's throat.
He would have been more like, you know, like, you know, green special forces, you know, tactical, like doing it in a certain way. And they would have shot it differently, too. This was just like basic, like, you know, here's a negative review of the movie. It got good reviews, but Kevin Thomas of the Los Angeles Times slammed the film as one of the most revolting exploitation pictures to come along in some time, and he called it some kind of ultimate and cynical calculation. The whole numbing predicament of the POW is perceptively, credibly depicted, but only to set up the carnage that follows. Surely the POWs don't deserve this kind of exploitation on the screen. So I wonder what he thought about First Blood after he saw that. Must have really loved that one.
Do you? I mean, one of the other kind of coming home movies I watched as a kid was like Missing in Action.
Oh yeah, Missing in Action. Yeah, I saw that too. That was just another, like, that was like First Blood before, or like, you know, actually that came out after First Blood, but like, you know, First Blood Part 2 was the first one I saw. That was like, actually, I saw that one before First Blood. So So I had to go back and watch First Blood, but they're all kind of the same. You know, Missing in Action is more of like closer to First Blood Part Two, where they're going back to try to get the, you know, the
more like a Canon Pictures action movie.
Yeah, it's that was sort of the stuff I grew up on. I didn't grow up on like the, you know, the character study, like you know, in of the Vietnam veteran. I grew up on the stuff where, like, you know, they're just action heroes type stuff. And I have to say, if I'm being honest, if I had to pick between First Blood and Rolling Thunder, I think I'd take First Blood over Rolling Thunder as a movie. I just prefer that movie more than Rolling Thunder. I think it's just as far as the action and stuff goes, and you know, it's just the one that I grew up on and I rewatched over and over again. So that was like, you know, like my version of that movie. But I think Rolling Thunder is a very good movie though. Okay, so that does it for our thoughts on Rolling Thunder. So we'll move into our Blu-ray picks for this episode. And I don't know if you want to go first or.
Sure. I got three, and one's actually just a reminder of, or let's say a repetition of one that you mentioned last time. And yep. So that's the second part of Shout Select Sonny Chiba collection, which gets you five or six really cool Sonny Chiba movies and great quality and some cool extras. Yeah, that's now ready for pre-order. And
I don't think I've seen any of those movies either.
I do have to say that I own something like one of those cheap ass old 10 movie DVD collections.
Oh yeah, the 10 pack, whatever.
Yeah, and some of them may be on it, but honestly, yeah. I've never watched that thing. It's been sitting on my shelf for decades, and I'll just probably throw it out and replace it with these cool Blu-rays at some point.
Yeah, like, let's see what's in there. The Defensive Power of Aikido, never seen that. 13 Steps of Mackie, never seen that. Karate Warriors, I did see that one. That's, you know, that's pretty good.
Probably the more popular one among those.
Yeah, The Great Okinawa Yakuza War, I haven't seen that one.
But it's The Great Okinawa Yakuza War.
That's the one. Karate for Life, I haven't seen that one. Go-Go 13, I haven't seen that one. And then the Okinawa War of 10 Years. I haven't seen that one. So I think what they're, you know, we have the ones that we know the most, like, you know, the Street Fighter movies and stuff like that. But then there's like other ones that like he did that like probably were never released over here. And those are probably that.
Yeah. And they already put the more popular ones in the first collection.
That's how they usually do it. As the collections go on, like the titles get like kind of like, you know, more and more obscure or not as great and stuff.
But I do like that, you know, if you're a completist or a cineast, you can get more and more, even though lesser known stuff on Blu-ray, which is really good.
Yep. True. Okay. My first pick is The Wicker Man. I just watched that this month for Shocktober, and it's one of my favorite, you know, horror movies. But it's a new 4K restoration, and you know, it has like some good extras, revisiting the locations, the Wicker Man at 50, the script, you know, an interview with Britt Eklund, a gallery, and you know, some other stuff, and interviews with some of the actors, and so that's like one of my favorite horror thrillers.
I'm actually not sure if I've ever seen it, but
yeah, it's really good. Yeah. And I think it inspired Midsommar. Did you ever see Midsommar?
I've seen that.
That would probably be a good double feature. They're both about like pagan, like, you know, cults and stuff. That type of thing. It's really good. Yeah. So that's my first pick.
My second one is it's not entirely new, but there's going to be a UK edition of the Samurai Wolf 1 and 2 double feature, which came out in May in the US, and it's going to come out probably the same edition, same specs, this side of the pond. And I've never seen those. Those are by, what is that?
Or Hideo Gosha.
Hideo Gosha, yeah.
Yeah.
So I like the gritty type, bloody samurai.
We did an episode with The Steel Edge of Revenge, which was also called, originally called Goyoken. That's a Hideo Gosha movie. And that was really good.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So that's the only one I've seen. That's the only film by him I've seen so far. So I haven't seen the Samurai Wolf films yet.
Mm-hmm. No, looking forward to it.
Okay. And my second pick is The Iron-Fisted Monk, which is another Sammo Hung film. And I reviewed the Prodigal Son, like, you know, on the, you know, last, over the last year I reviewed it. And, I really liked it. So I'm going to recommend another Sammo Hung film, and that has an audio commentary by Frank Jang and interviews with Sammo Hung and interview with Casanova Wong in the original theatrical trailer. and that's from Arrow Video.
They're putting a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, they, a lot of good classic kung fu films.
My third is also Arrow Video, and that's the 4K edition of Barbarella.
Oh yeah, cool.
And also because a friend of mine, he produced some of the interviews that are on there. This is a two-disc edition with plenty of interviews, discussions with Tim Lucas, interviews, trailers, video spots, video essays, tons of stuff, new artwork. It's a 4K and a regular Blu-ray. So this is, you know, if you see some of Jane Fonda in space.
Yeah, that's an awesome film.
And John Philip Law, then this is a good edition.
Yep. And I think that, I think when Barbarella came out, I think it played with like Diabolik on some double features at some point, because it was like John Philip Law was in both of them. And it was sort of like, I think, were they both Paramount? I'm not sure.
Yes, they were. Yeah.
So I think they put those on double bills. That would have been a fun double bill. Like both of those.
Yeah, very different.
Crazy movies. Like, you know, late 60s, swinging 60s, psychedelia. Okay, my other pick is Black Sabbath, the Mario Bava classic.
Oh, yeah.
It's from Kino Lorber, and that has an audio commentary by Tim Lucas. And he always does really great commentaries, especially for the Mario Bava movies.
Yep, he does.
He did the one, I think he did one with John Philip Law for Diabolik? I think that's him and John Philip Law did. That was a really good one. That was awesome on that DVD from years ago. I remember that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that should be a really
good one. Because he passed away in 2008 or
I think it was right before that, right after he died, right after he recorded that commentary. So that was a really, you know, but it was great, like, you know, to hear like his thoughts on that movie, because one of our favorites, Danger Diabolik.
Yeah, it's cool. And actually, I'm actually looking forward to, because there's new adaptations of that comic, a two-part movie from out of Italy. That's only once from last year, the ones from the year before.
Wouldn't it be interesting to see like a Diabolik remake, like?
Well, it's not technically a remake. There's just a new adaptation of the same comic book.
Right. But I don't know what you call it. Reimagining, I guess, or a reimagining.
That'll be interesting.
Yeah, that sounds good. So I guess that'll wrap this episode up, unless there's anything else you want to.
All good from my end.
Okay.
It's always good to talk about 70s movies.
Classic grindhouse movies.
Yeah, 70s is a good decade to explore grindhouse movies.
There's always good stuff to find. And, you know, so this is Pete Roberts, and this has been 42nd Street Forever. Thanks to Seb for chatting about the movies with us.
Always a pleasure, Pete.
And we'll see you next time. Take care.
At the grindhouse.
See you on the deuce.
Cheers, man.
Cheers.
San Antonio, it's really good to see you. It's been a while, but you've been on my mind. I've seen your rolling hills and winding rivers, so clear that I could almost make them mine. I can almost see the old Bandera.